Hawaii's drivers are turning to electric cars in greater numbers than ever. Sales went up 26% last year. They have significant advantages, especially for island dwellers whose daily mileage falls well within the range of electric cars. The Blue Planet Foundation is sponsoring an electric island drive this Sunday, a caravan-style electric vehicle parade to close out National Drive Electric Week. Shem Lawler is the Blue Planet Foundation's Clean Transportation Director, and for purposes of our discussion, we asked him to look beyond the environmental benefits and make the case for the electric car.
Most of the time you hear people talk about the environmental benefits and
right.
the air quality benefits, but there is a very strong case for electric vehicles just on consumer needs. Electric vehicles, depending on how and where you charge, can be one-third the cost of the fuel cost of a gasoline car.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're filling up with gas and you get 25 miles per gallon, you're probably paying 12 to 14 cents per mile of driving
mm-hmm.
fuel costs. With an EV, you're looking at 3 to 6 cents per mile. So there's significant cost savings on the fuel side. Additionally, electric vehicles have quite a bit fewer moving parts. You know, your gasoline car, you have a transmission, you have the pistons and all the support systems for the engine. In an electric car, you basically just have an electric motor, which consists of a bundle of copper, and you run a current through, and it starts spinning.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple, very very economical, and so there's very few things that can go wrong. People tend to say that you save about you maybe pay 1/4 of the total maintenance costs with an electric car that you would pay with a standard gasoline car.
And that's over a period of time.
The lifetime, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty significant savings. Additionally, people who get into an electric car, one of the things we do a lot is we do electric vehicle ride and drive events. And it's really interesting to see people the first time they drive an electric car, and they're pretty shocked at how powerful they are.
Mm-hmm.
If you are doing a high-speed race on the freeway, maxing out, an electric car is probably not going to compete with a fast sports car. But off of the line, electric vehicles, all of the power is available immediately. So there's no delay. There's a lot of torque. And, whether you're merging into a lane and need a sunburst of power or what have you, people really tend to enjoy driving an electric car much more than a gasoline car. At least I know I do.
These the pleasures that you describe are the pleasures that are associated with a great big honking gas burning engine, right? 400 horsepower under the hood and a couple of
right.
carburetors and all that.
Right. That's one of the reasons we do those electric ride drive events is because you really need to get people into an electric car to feel that, to experience that, to kind of change their minds.
Yeah.
Overall, the vast majority of people, once you get them an electric car, they don't want to go back to a gasoline vehicle.
What's different about a hybrid?
So there's a couple different kinds of hybrids. There's a traditional hybrid, which essentially has a small electric motor that can help start a vehicle off of the line, that has that low-end torque that is more efficient with an electric car than a gasoline car. And then they have what we call regenerative braking. So when you're slowing down, it actually takes energy back from the wheels and puts it back in the battery. But then for most of the driving, you have an electric engine. There are also cars we call plug-in hybrids, which have a larger electric motor, just like a regular fully battery electric vehicle,
mm-hmm.
but then have like a small gas tank and either a small engine that actually drive the wheels, or sometimes, in some cases, a small engine that can just recharge the battery once the battery's getting low, to drive the electric engine.
It's still primarily running on the electric. It is running on the
electric. Yeah, it actually only runs on the electric battery, but it has that small gasoline engine to recharge the battery if you run out of charge.
Just the way cars do with their batteries now.
Right, essentially, right.
Yeah.
And then you have fully battery electric, what we call BEV, B-E-V, battery electric vehicles, which is your Teslas, your Nissan Leaf, your Chevy Bolt with a B.
And that's a big rechargeable battery?
Exactly.
How big? I mean,
well,
compared to an engine, say.
In terms of size, it really depends on the vehicle. Typically, they try to make it flat. So you may be like 4 to 8 inches thick and then covering most of the bottom of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the capacity, the way we talk about batteries in electric vehicles is in terms of kilowatt hours. So typically, an electric car can drive about 3.5 miles on 1 kilowatt hour of battery capacity. Mm-hmm. So like the Nissan Leaf I drive is a 24 kilowatt hour battery. I can get somewhere between 80 and 100 miles of range depending on how hilly the terrain is and how much I'm using the air conditioning and whatnot. The first generation EVs, which really launched in around 2010, 2011, that's your Nissan Leafs and Chevy Bolts. And a little bit later, the BMW i3s.
Chevy Volt with a V.
Volt with a V, right.
Yeah.
Those all had like 16 to 24 kilowatt hour batteries.
Mm-hmm.
At the time when those vehicles were first released, it cost about $1,000 per kilowatt hour of battery capacity. So the Nissan Leaf was, you know, about a $25,000 battery pack in the first models. 6 years later, those prices have fallen down to $150 to $200 per kilowatt hour. So about 80 to 85% reduction in the cost of batteries. So that makes it a lot easier for manufacturers to put larger batteries in, more energy capacity, and obviously longer range at lower prices. So we expect that those trends will continue, and there's a lot of reports that are out there that say sometime between 2020 and 2025, the battery electric cars are going to cost essentially the same as conventional vehicles.
Right now they cost what? Average, maybe $10,000 more than a comparable.
It depends
gas
on. I mean,
car.
It's very model specific. There's a couple things that are contributing to the higher prices that we've seen. The first thing was the battery costs, but the second thing is just scale. Automakers, you know, they have. If you're talking about like Honda, the Accord, the Civic, the scale of production that they've built in their manufacturing capacity is pretty big, and the larger the scale, the lower the per unit cost.
Sure,
and so. We anticipate that as manufacturers start scaling up the amount and the number of models of EVs that they build, they're going to achieve greater scale of, you know, economies of scale with the battery production, with the actual car production, and that'll cause the prices to fall. And then obviously the battery costs have been falling steadily for the last decade, really, and that'll contribute significantly to the cost falling. And then, you know, engines, gasoline engines do cost a lot of money. That's a lot of the cost of the battery or the conventional vehicles. And so at some point, the differential between the cost of the battery and the engine is going to be basically the same. And then with the lower fuel and maintenance costs of the electric vehicles, I have a hard time believing that 10 years from now, anyone's going to have a rational reason for buying a gasoline car anymore.
Shem Lawler is the Clean Transportation Director for the Blue Planet Foundation and the Sustainable Transportation Coalition of Hawaii. They're hosting their second annual Electric Island Drive this Sunday. The caravan-style electric vehicle parade is a part of National Drive Electric Week, celebrating zero-emissions vehicles and highlighting their benefits. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Imagine if you could experience the future right now.
So we create prototypes that actually give people a very emotional, tangible perspective of that future.
All of its upsides and all of its downsides.
You have a lot more weather uncertainty. You have food shortages.
I'm Guy Raz, The Future and Its Consequences. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday at 3 p.m.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, what happens when successful people veer away from the straight and narrow? But first, your quiz.
Umau, ukaho olabe,
If you've lived in or visited downtown Hilo, you've probably noticed the Eshata building, a colorful two-story structure that is a nostalgic reflection of the architectural style of Honolulu architect William C. Fuhrer. Originally built in 1912 with construction costs of $25,000, the building was an outgrowth of the thriving Eshata Shoten, Shoten being Japanese for store. One of the conditions the U.S. government had for selling the Front Street, now Kamehameha Avenue property, to the usual wooden structures being built in Hilo. Listed as a state historic site since 1989 and added to the National Historic Register in 1991, the building was recently renovated, and you can see vintage transoms above the aluminum doors and windows, some of which are from the original construction. For today's quiz, we want to know what the S in the Eshata building stands for. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Claire Hannes, an immigration attorney, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Martin Scully, the former pharmaceutical executive who has been convicted on securities fraud charges, got his bail revoked yesterday. He had sent out a social media message offering $5,000 for a lock of Hillary Clinton's hair, a message the judge interpreted as a very public threat. What was he thinking? This is a man who was already successful before he made the high-risk moves that got him sent to jail. Andrew Snyder is a psychotherapist who works with white-collar offenders, and we asked him to take us inside that mindset.
I don't think anyone ventures out in their career with the expectation that they'll end up in prison at some point for a crime they've done in relationship to their career, their profession.
We don't give that much thought to the psychology of the white-collar criminal, but that's been your milieu, yeah?
That's my niche. I explore, I work with offenders who've been prosecuted and are facing prison for white-collar crimes. It could be bank fraud, tax fraud, insider trading. And they find themselves in their 30s, 40s, never in trouble with the law before, and they're heading to prison. It's a scary time for them. Were there signs before? There could have been, but I've discovered that usually there's a perfect psychological storm that's brewing for most of them that I've worked with. They've had hardships, challenges, and in a twist of fate, they decide to cross the line and engage in white-collar crime. Many with the expectation that they're going to cover it up or repay the money that they stole.
Part of that is being a function of their access to sums of money, right?
Opportunity, certainly. Whereas other people would maybe steal from the till or from the inventory at a warehouse, for instance. They oftentimes have access to large sums of money. And the wherewithal, the intelligence, the know-how, excuse me.
Well, a large sum of money, if you're in the right position, can be a keystroke away on your computer, right?
A few
keystrokes.
Yeah, indeed. One of the cases that actually catapulted me into doing this work was a prominent New York attorney, Mark Dreyer, who I guess it was about 2008, right around the time of Bernie Madoff, was discovered to have committed a $400 million fraud. Mm-hmm. And his began taking loans out. He couldn't get money in his own name. He didn't have the credit. He wanted to start his own boutique law firm. And he didn't have the credit, so he started taking money out in a client's name, mm-hmm. and keeping the money for himself to finance his law firm. Mm-hmm. And it started at $2 million, and then he realized I need a little bit more money. It became $5 million. The end result was $400 million fraud. Whew. Yeah, and he's doing a 20-year sentence now,
yeah.
in federal prison.
But that, clearly his ambitions snowballed, ran away with him. I bet he started out thinking he was going to pay back that $2 million.
He sure did. There's a lot of magical thinking.
Yeah.
And it's not grounded in reality. In his case, he had had some hardships. Mm-hmm. He was going through a divorce. His law partnership broke up. He lost a case that he had been working on for about 10 years. Again, he was in New York, and it was right around the time of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine, he didn't say this, but I imagine, what do I got to lose?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go for broke.
Mm-hmm.
And he started taking the money out, and in another person's name, one of his clients, a billionaire, and he never did repay the money.
One of the things I'm going to guess that one of the things that your clients do is spend a lot of time giving themselves permission, a lot of rationalizing, justifying. He's a billionaire. He won't miss it, right?
Indeed.
In the case of that last
rationalization is a big key. And people I've spoken with, they've never appreciated the downside until they get caught.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed Rumi Khan, who was involved in the Raj Rajaratnam case out of New York. He's a billionaire hedge fund owner that went to prison serving an 11-year sentence. And she was a cooperating witness. She ended up going to prison for a year. And she told me, she said that the prison sentence was easy enough. I got through that. The tough reality is once you're finished and out of prison, there's no work.
Yeah.
Your reputation is gone. Your name is mud.
Nobody will touch you.
Exactly.
And the thing to which you have devoted your life.
And your education invested so much. And it would really benefit them had they had someone that they could have spoken with. I tend to believe they're isolated.
Mm-hmm.
They don't discuss these personal challenges they're having with others.
Mm-hmm.
They come up with some wild solutions.
You know, this sounds like other types of slipping downward things that people do, slipping into alcohol, slipping into drugs, slipping into behavior that maybe justifies itself to you a little bit at a time. You know, I got drunk last night and I didn't do so bad, so I'm going to get drunk again tonight. You know that what I'm saying? That kind of sliding into behavior a step at a time.
I just heard recently, and I don't recall where, if you're digging a hole or if you found yourself in a hole, stop digging. and it's really true. Many of the clients say it's a slippery slope. Once you cross that line, it begins to get easier each time you do it.
Yeah.
And again, if you're not accountable to anyone, if you're not discussing these choices you're making with other people,
mm-hmm.
It gets easier and easier.
Sounds as if family and relationships are a saving grace to some people to move away from temptation.
Family, of course, is critical.
Yeah.
They don't go to you to work.
Right.
They're not with you in the office. If you don't have a mentor, someone that you can talk with about these problems, or these issues, these challenges, mm-hmm. It could spell disaster for some people.
Well, there's one thing that you mentioned, Andrew, as a part of the profile, people who had been through hardships. And it has often seemed to me that people who have been at one point in their life really poor have this resolve, make or break, never to go back there. Have you seen some of
yes,
that?
Yes, it comes up a lot. People from impoverished backgrounds.
Yeah, never going back there.
Single family, raised by their mother, poor. And they had the opportunity to go to school. They're intelligent. They make the right decisions career-wise. And they're ambitious, highly competitive, and a desire to win.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've discovered is, and it's been written about as well, many business executives don't have an awareness of the emotions that drive them to succeed. And what you're bringing up, the impoverished background,
mm-hmm.
not going back, they will go to great lengths to win, to fill themselves up. And
yeah.
it becomes more or less about the money and more about success by each step of winning. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are. Yeah, very much. And in fact, what you're most making sense about to me is that I'm really getting the feeling that at the highest level of financial dealings, having the advice, the counsel of a psychologist can be very helpful.
Indeed, there's a certain personality set I find with some of the offenders.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, they're ambitious, they're competitive, they want to succeed, but there's also the thrill of winning.
Yeah.
And they will sometimes impulsively engage in practices for the sake of an adrenaline rush versus noble, honorable results.
Yeah.
It's more personal, impulsive, lacks concern for people who may be hurt.
Mm-hmm.
A good example, out of Alaska, a dentist in Anchorage was, I guess, about 6 months ago. It was in the papers. He had been charged by the licensing bureau for extracting a patient's tooth, riding a hoverboard, and recording it. It's ridiculous.
As a stunt? Do you mean just to show off?
I think he had mastered his skills
uh-huh.
as a dentist, and that was no longer a challenge. The challenge was to extract the tooth riding a hoverboard and then to have a record of it by someone videotaping it. I'm not sure what came first. I think it was thereafter they discovered he was also committing insurance fraud.
Uh-huh.
So he's been indicted by the U.S. attorney. His license has been revoked because of the practice of the hoverboard. But there's that personality that's not enough.
Yeah.
He has to spice the game up even a little bit more. He's mastered what everyone in his profession has done, but he's going to take it a little further.
You know, Andrew, this is an argument in the favor of simple pleasures, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed. Or creating, and that's where the work that I do as an executive coach, finding other activities that fulfill that thrill-seeking behavior.
Yeah.
In a productive way, a constructive way that doesn't harm anyone, that gives purpose to your life. There are people who thrill seek, who need that rush. It could be mountain biking.
Yeah.
It could be climbing the Alps. These certain goals that they can set for themselves outside of work that will fulfill them.
Andrew Snyder is a psychotherapist and advisor who prepares white-collar first-time offenders and their families for imprisonment. He's a retired California correctional officer and a marriage and family therapist.
Count on us to be responsive to the news of the day, issues of concern to our community and to you, our listeners. We hear you. Starting September 18th, we'll be bringing back shows many of you have asked for, including On the Media on Mondays, Freakonomics on Tuesdays, and Left, Right, and Center on Fridays, all on HPR 1 at 7 p.m. Visit HawaiiPublicRadio.org for more about the exciting new lineup starting September 18th.
There are perks, both large and small, to being an elected official. And if you spend much time around a state capitol or county council office, you may wonder if the real currency of government isn't cookies, donuts, and manapua. The gifts lawmakers routinely get range from tiny to lavish, from innocent to dubious. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair has been offered his share of manapua at government offices through the years. He looks at Hawaii's culture of gift-giving in today's Civil Beat reality check. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Chris. Nice setup. Thanks for the plug.
Well, you know, I've worked, as you know, at the Capitol for a few sessions, and I'm always worried going into a session about how much weight I'm going to get. Right?
It's really quite remarkable just how much food, particularly local favorites like manapua, are given by people, constituents, but also, you know, government officials, lobbyists, any number of people. We love food. It's sort of the gift of aloha here, but it, you know, some lawmakers are actually quite detailed in actually reporting this to the Ethics Commission, because you have to report gifts. And the reason you have to do that is the Ethics Commission wants to make sure there's not someone trying to unduly buy influence to try and persuade a lawmaker or an appointed official, you know, to do something for them. So so mostly it's fairly benign, like manapua, cookies, brownies, any number of delights. Other things kind of raise your eyebrow a little bit.
What are some of the things toward the high end of gift giving that we see?
Well, Rowena Akana, the OHA trustee, has received $22,000 from Abigail Kuananakoa. Most of that she has used for legal fees. So that's fairly significant. She has been involved with legal battles with other trustees. Mm-hmm. Travel is a very expensive proposition. Quite a few lawmakers go to conferences, and most of them look to be fairly above board, the National Conference of State Legislatures and whatnot. But a couple of our lawmakers actually went to Taiwan, nearly $6,000 each for air travel, you know, hotel, ground transportation, meals. That really adds up. Mind you, that's another organization, in this case, an agency in Taiwan, paying our lawmakers to come visit them. And so certainly that raises at least an eyebrow. If the Ethics Commission does think that's a problem, I imagine they'll look into it. It may not be. We do travel quite a lot to a lot of different places, I mean, the lawmakers.
Well, frequently with conferences, golf tournaments, you know, weekend things like that, it's, you know, there's a fairly innocent premise to the whole thing. But at some level, somebody's trying to get heard, right, to get some influence.
That's right. And I think there's been more awareness in recent years. You mentioned golf, golf courses, golf games. That's come up. And there has been some reports of undue influence, I don't know, concerning the rail project, other kind of things. Things vary at the county level versus the state. Mm-hmm. What's important to understand is that there are rules, there are guidelines, both at the county level and the state level, that say, look, you know, you can't accept this. This might not be a good thing for you to do. And by the way, if you have any doubt, if you think maybe it's not a good idea to accept those free tickets to a function, maybe you ought to call the Ethics Commission and get some advice rather than actually accepting it and reporting it and then getting in trouble later.
I like that some people are actually going to the trouble of reporting a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah. It's remarkable. From the Honolulu Theater for Youth, of all places, probably not trying to too much unduly influence the legislature. But yes, many lawmakers said they got PJ and B's, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, rather, from HTY. Good for them for disclosing fully where the influence is coming from.
Oh, those can be pretty influential. Thanks, Chad.
Depends on the jelly.
Exactly. Thanks very much. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. Jamal Yogas is a man on a spiritual quest, stimulated in part by his surfing days in Hawaii. He relived his days as a teenage seeker and soul surfer in his first memoir, Saltwater Buddha. His search widens and takes him farther afield in his follow-up memoir, All Our Waves Are Water. He's in Hawaii on his book tour. Hi, Jamal. Thanks for coming with us.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Hawaii is a place where people actually understand what you mean with the term soul surfer, right?
I think so. I mean, it's a term that gets thrown around a lot as, you know, what does it really mean? I think the reality is that most surfers are soul surfers. You know, a lot of times pro surfers get this bad rap as like they don't really like to surf. They're just after the money. They're full of it. Those guys like to surf as much as anybody does. And
maybe
everybody
more.
Gets a great feeling in the water. That's why they're doing it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whether you're doing it for a living or because you just love to play around, I think the ocean feeds us. It makes us peaceful. It brings – even the neuroscience shows that just when you get in the water and float, you get out of sort of prefrontal cortex planning mm-hmm. mode, mm-hmm. and there's a more distributed set of points. I mean, this is assuming the ocean doesn't make you afraid, but
yeah.
if you're a person who likes the water you instantly go into a more sort of hyper-present mode, and mm-hmm. that's healing for us.
It demands, the ocean demands that you understand your presence in it as being in the presence of a power infinitely more powerful than yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons mystics and philosophers have drawn on the ocean
yeah.
for teachings. You know, in the Zen tradition, they compare the individual self to a wave on the ocean, and the Buddha nature as the ocean itself. And Rumi, the great Sufi poet, says, you know, we're not a drop in the ocean, we're the entire ocean in a drop. And so there's all these great metaphors to draw on. But then also when you're actually in the ocean, it's so dynamic, you can't fall asleep. You know, there.
Right.
I make a lot of connections between sitting meditation and surfing. And one of the things that I think if you're a surfer and you meditate, you can benefit from your surfing experience, because when you're on your cushion, you can fall asleep, you can zone out. But when you're out there in the ocean, you can't. You need to stay
yeah.
alert. And
yeah.
so, again, there's a sort of hyper-presence that the sea invokes.
Did you become aware of that early in your life?
I always loved the ocean. My dad was a surfer. We lived in the Azores, Portugal, mm-hmm. when I was about 3 to 6, and we were out there body surfing every day. And we just took it, you know, the beach was just a wonderful place to be. I think it wasn't probably until I had more frightening experiences when I was really learning to surf in Hawaii, you know, got my face grated on the reef when mm-hmm. I was out on the Big Island, where I realized, wow, you know, you can't zone out for a minute here.
Yeah.
Because and that's essential. You can bring that on to land, you know, that and the water makes you naturally more aware. I think it's one of the reasons it's so healing for autistic children and people with sensory integration. Having all that pressure of the water on all your nerves makes you less sort of in your head. A lot of times we're just telling infinite stories about things that might happen or things that happened mm-hmm. in the past, and we're not really living now and aware of what's going on. We're sort of naturally like walking around with a cell phone, but the cell phone's in our And now we actually have the cell phone too. And so in the water, you can't bring your cell phone, which is great. But then you also can't be spinning out an infinite stories. And so, you know, I continue to learn that every day.
Spinning out, that's an interesting phrase, spinning out an infinite stories, because, you know, anyone who is goes on a spiritual quest, tries to learn to meditate, finds that your head is full of noise, right? If I try to quiet my mind down, I just can't believe all the stuff that's flying around in there.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, it's one of the first things you learn when you sit and meditate. Everybody thinks they're a terrible meditator because they think they're supposed to have this instant experience of, oh, now I'm not thinking.
The void, yeah.
That's a myth. And
good.
The idea is really to take an observer's perspective of the mind, and that's one of the amazing things about the mind, is that the mind can distance itself from itself.
Yeah.
And so in meditation, you take the perspective of watching your thoughts much like you might watch waves on the ocean, so you don't identify with them so much, because so much of our suffering comes from identifying with those waves. We have a wave of jealousy or a wave of
attachment.
Of attachment or fear. And that spins out more stories. We say, oh, I'm always jealous, or my parents screwed me up, or
I can't control this or that craving.
Exactly. And so the storytelling and really the resistance to those waves is often creates more suffering than just the wave itself. And that's part of the theme of this book, All Our Waves Are Water, is to see that, well, are those big wave emotional waves of fear or jealousy or anger so bad in and of themselves if you don't attach a story to them, or can you just let them pass by, much like a stormy day mm-hmm. at the ocean can be beautiful if you just kind of say, oh, well, it is. You know, that is a part of life.
Attach a story to them, as in dragging your own story into it?
Dragging your own story into it, and the key piece is attaching an identity story to it, because our minds are wild. This is the biology we're saddled with, where we have an unconscious and a conscious mind, and things are going at a rapid fire pace. And that isn't necessarily, there isn't a self in there that's navigating those. They're just, when you sit down in silence and you watch, there's old memories of TV shows and big emotions and planning, and those are happening nonstop, not by your own force of will. And so a lot of our emotions that we experience come from attaching an identity story to those. So if you sit for or spend some time in nature where you can quiet the mind and you're not having infinite inputs, mm-hmm. you can actually one, the waves start to find space, so you have a little bit more peace of mind. And two, you can start to see how these emotions and these emotional stories that we identify with aren't necessarily true. They're not facts. Mm-hmm. They are just sort of phenomena that the mind is churning out. And so as a meditator, you can kind of decide, I'm going to let this wave go because it's not useful to me, and B, it's not really true, mm-hmm. With a capital T. Or, hey, this is a great joyful wave. You know, I'm in love with my newborn child, and I'm going to ride it. And then you're kind of surfing that ride, and that's an enjoyable part of being a human. But when you start to meditate, you can start to choose. Do I want to ride this wave, or I don't want to let it go?
It sounds like absent meditation, we just sort of attach ourselves to everything, every wave that comes flowing through.
We do. We're just heedless if we don't have at least some way of anchoring ourselves in the present and being able to take a perspective on our own minds. And a good portion of the world is walking around heedless like that and out of control of their own emotions. And, so it's a key thing to learn. I think kids should learn it from a young age.
Well, it's very easy to feel as if you are the captive of your mind rather than the captor, in a sense, yeah? That it's going to go, it's going to take you know not where, and you might not like it very much.
Well, you are, and most of what you're feeling is on top of that run by your unconscious, which is, you know, the lizard brain is churning out all these desires about survival and sex and anger, et cetera. And if you don't have just a little handle on that, that's going to run you rather than you being able to say, well, you know, actually that's not going to help me if I go get angry at my 3-year-old or something. You know?
I think there's probably a lot of people who are hearing this and identifying with all or part of it. Thanks very much, Jamal.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Jamal Yogas is the author of All Our Waves Are Water, just released by HarperCollins. Be signing copies tomorrow at 2 p.m. in the Barnes & Noble store at Honolulu's Ala Moana Mall on Sunday at 5 p.m. at Lumeria Maui.
Aloha, I'm Kyle Itani, chef owner of Hopscotch Restaurant. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In the show, we asked you about the Eshata building in downtown Hilo. This colorful concrete structure is home to retail shops, commercial offices, and a restaurant called Cafe Pesto. Listed as a state historic site since 1989 and added to the National Historic Register in 1991. The two-story building was constructed in 1912 as a second site for Hata's family store to sell Japanese silks, kimonos, and Eastern souvenirs and provisions. Price tag was a whopping $25,000. And unlike the wooden structures of the time, it has survived two major tsunamis. Hata Sadano Sukue was the name of the Japanese merchant who was the patriarch of the Hilo business that also branched out to Honolulu and Japan. So the next time you walk along Kamehameha Avenue and you see the signage fronting this historic site, you know that the S stands for Sadano Sukue. And that's today's quiz. Jerry Hamamoto, a Hilo resident who loves history, making him a man after our own hearts, got that right today. Congratulations, Jerry. You're going to get a prize. And that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz you'd like to share, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Next Wednesday in Hilo, the State Board of Land and Natural Resources will hear oral arguments in the contested case hearing for the Conservation District use application for the 30-meter telescope at the Mauna Kea Science Reserve. It's likely to offer a thorough summary of the TMT arguments, pro and con, and reporter Kuve Hiraishi is on hand to help us sort out what it all means. Hi, Kuve. Thanks
Aloha.
For coming.
Hello, Chris.
Now, this is not a public hearing, but it is one in which attorneys are going to present oral arguments. Is that right?
There will be attorneys present, but it actually is. They've got 23 contested case hearing parties.
Uh-huh.
So these are mostly opponents of the telescope. There are about a handful of supporters of the telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And what they get to do is sort of make their case before the board decides on whether to issue this permit.
Given that the preponderance is probably going to be against, is it possible to make any kind of a prediction about where this is going to end up?
Well, the recommendation on the table was what retired Judge Ricky Miyamano had recommended at the end of the 5 months of contested case hearings testimony.
Mm-hmm.
So what she recommended was that the board approve and move forward with issuing the permit. So
that is
actually, the proposed recommendation on the table. So with that being said, the opponents need to sort through all the facts that have been presented
mm-hmm.
in Ricky Miyamano's, I think, 305-page final document. And they're going to go ahead and try to weed out some of those facts and say, no, this isn't a fact that shouldn't be considered, so that the board can maybe change their minds. But that's what's on the table next Wednesday.
What are some of the facts likely to be cited, or things likely to be alleged?
Right. So there are about, let's see, there are environmental cases being made against the telescope and the mm-hmm. impact that this large telescope, no, let's say an extremely large telescope is actually what it's being called, yeah. the TMT, is about 180 feet tall, so that's 18 stories. And they're talking about the possible impacts to the habitat there, both environmental and also with the species that mm-hmm. are there. So those facts will probably be weeded out. And also, of course, the cultural practitioners that are opponents to the telescope have continued to say that this is considered a sacred site mm-hmm. and that they are adamantly opposed to any sort of hindrances on their cultural and practitioner rights on the mountain.
Were those arguments made earlier, prior to this whole project being approved?
Yes. So throughout the entire process, these arguments have been made, and some of the conditions, so there were about 31 conditions that the judge, Judge Ricky Mamano, had included in her summary. Mm-hmm. And these were thought of as ways to sort of maybe not combat, but find a middle ground and kind of compromise on some of these arguments that are being made. So, for example, one of the conditions is that employees of TMT would be mandated to take cultural classes mm-hmm. that where they can understand the cultural and environmental habitats around, in the entire along the mountain, but also that I think something like $1 million be put towards educating STEM education on the Big Island mm-hmm. so that students will be able to move into these positions and be working at TMT or in astronomy in general.
Because of the pro TMT arguments have to do with one thing, the Hawaiian tradition of wayfinding, but also the creation of opportunities for young science-bound young Hawaii men and women, right?
Exactly. And one of the big proponents, the Pueo group, has been very much on the bandwagon on supporting sort of the educational and what could come to the community apart from the actual science. So I'm not sure how familiar are with the science of the telescope, but this telescope is supposed to have the largest prime mirror, which will allow scientifically for us to find very old light, if you will.
And deeper into space than anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. And answer questions like what life, if there is life on other planets outside our solar system, and the physics of planet system and star formation. I mean, scientists will geek out over this telescope. And I think on the opponent side, they're not necessarily opposed to science. It's just it being built on that particular mountain.
Well, the cultural education offered to sort of mitigate the impact of the telescope, it doesn't really address a building that's 180 feet tall.
Right. And I think it's also been said that there are larger issues beyond just the telescope at play in this contested case hearing and mm-hmm. in the entire process of building this telescope on Mauna Kea. But next Wednesday will be sort of the culmination of the contested case hearing, but also be the next step in whether or not they're going to move forward with it.
Assuming, a negative result, working against Judge Amano's hearing, would that halt the process, or would that just be a kind of a speed bump?
It has been said by TMT officials that they do have an alternate site in mind in the Canary Islands in Spain. So if they cannot get
it halted
things
going, in Hawaii, though.
Yes. If they cannot get it going on Mauna Kea by next April, they do plan to relocate to Spain.
So, yeah, because what I'm getting at is, when does this get resolved, yay or nay? And it, next Wednesday doesn't resolve it. It moves it forward, though, closer.
Exactly. So you'll have to tune in to see what will happen next Wednesday.
Okay, fair enough, Kuvei. Thanks very much. Kuvei Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter.
Hi, aloha. I'm Melina Lilios, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org.
So in Hillary Clinton's new book, she comes across as honest, emotional, even funny. So either it turns out she was a human being all along, or her operating system got a major upgrade. We'll conduct our own inquiry. Plus, Joshua Hami of Queens of the Stone Age tells us how he got from polka music to stoner rock. Join us for this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 11, following Radiolab.
On the next On Being, Altering the Calculus of Hope with writer Juno Diaz.
I'm a child of blackness. Blackness was not meant to survive, and we have survived. We have thrived, and we've given this world more genius than we have ever received.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Sunday morning at 10, right after the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, documentarian Ken Burns' Telefies documentary about the Vietnam War is likely to set off a round of national soul-searching. We'll look back on the conflict from the perspective of two local veterans, and we'll be taking your calls. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 792-8217, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.